You're listening to Northern Crimes.
Alaska is a land of extremes. Vast wilderness, brutal cold, and breathtaking isolation. But it's not just the weather that turns dangerous. People disappear here. Bodies turn up with no names. Planes vanish from the sky. Even serial killers leave victims behind that no one can identify. In this video, we're diving into five of Alaska's most chilling unsolved mysteries, stories that remain unanswered decades later. These are the cases that confound detectives, haunt families, and challenge everything we think we know about the last frontier. This is Northern Crimes.
Tonight, the remains of a murder victim known only as Bone 17 for nearly 40 years.
Am I going to jump up on the table? Am I going to scream? That's what I felt like doing.
They're going to tell you something that does not line up with anything I tell you because I'm two different people, basically.
You're listening to Northern Crimes, true crime and mystery from Alaska, Canada, and the Pacific Northwest. Today's episode is Unsolved Mysteries from Alaska. It was July 1980 when utility workers checking power lines near Aklutna Lake Road made a chilling discovery: the body of a young woman buried in a shallow grave outside of Anchorage. She had no ID, no missing persons report, and no one waiting for her return. For over four decades, she's been known only by a name tied to where she was found, Aklutna Annie. The medical examiner believed she was between 16 and 25, around 5 feet tall, with light brown hair tinged with red. She wore a brown leather jacket, jeans, and red knee-high boots, the kind you'd remember. Her jewelry was distinctive: turquoise studded copper bracelet, beaded necklace, gold hoop earrings, and a Timex watch with a brown face. What makes this case even more disturbing is that we know who killed her, but not who she was. In 1984, serial killer Robert Hansen confessed to Annie's murder, saying she was his first victim. By then, Hansen was infamous, a quiet Anchorage baker and father. He'd secretly abducted, assaulted, and murdered at least 17 women between 1971 and 1983, often flying them into the wilderness to hunt them like prey. According to Hansen's confession, he picked up Annie in downtown Anchorage sometime in late 1979. When she realized he wasn't taking her home, she panicked. He pulled a gun and told her to, quote,
"Do exactly as I say, and you won't get hurt."
He drove her toward Aklutna Lake, but when his truck got stuck in the mud, she tried to run. Hansen caught her, dragged her down, and stabbed her in the back with a hunting knife as she pleaded for her life. Detective Maxine Farrell, one of the few investigators who believed a serial killer was targeting women in Anchorage, suspected Annie had been a dancer or a sex worker. Her clothing and jewelry matched those worn by women from the city's nightlife scene, a detail Farrell had seen far too many times. Over the years, many missing women were compared to Aklutna Annie, including Roxanne Eastland and Megan Emmerich. But DNA testing ruled them out. Forensic artists have created facial reconstructions, and her case remains open, but no name has ever been confirmed. Today, she lies in Anchorage Memorial Park Cemetery beneath a headstone marked only Jane Doe, died 1980. She is the only known victim of Robert Hansen who remains unidentified. As advocate Autumn Smith once said,
"She deserves just as much of a search for her people as any other victim, as any other survivor."
Even when a killer is caught, some stories are left unfinished. Aklutna Annie's real name, her life before the violence, is still missing. Every 4th of July, thousands gather in Seward, Alaska, to witness one of the state's most grueling traditions, the Mount Marathon Race. It's just 3 miles long, but with a vertical climb of over 3,000 feet straight up a mountain face, it's not for the faint of heart. In 2012, it became the backdrop for a mystery that remains unsolved to this day. That year, 66-year-old Anchorage businessman Michael Amiter decided to run Mount Marathon for the first time. Despite the dangerous terrain and slick, foggy conditions, he was determined to finish. Around 6 p.m., a race official saw him just 200 feet from the summit, the last confirmed sighting of Amiter. He never came back down. What makes this disappearance so unsettling is that Mount Marathon towers directly over the town of Seward. It's not deep wilderness. You can see the mountain from nearly every street. And during the race, it's lined with volunteers and packed with spectators. And yet, somehow, Amiter vanished in plain sight. As soon as he was reported missing, a massive search effort was launched. Helicopters equipped with infrared, search dogs, and dozens of volunteers combed the trails, ravines, and cliffs. His scent was picked up briefly, but the trail ended abruptly at an old structure high on the mountain. No trace of him was ever found. No clothing, no equipment, nothing. The conditions that day were unusually treacherous. Two other runners were seriously injured. One fell off a cliff and suffered internal injuries, while another broke both legs and sustained a traumatic brain injury after slipping on the same descent. Lemiter's daughter, Marianne, spent more than a month hiking the mountain herself. She wanted to understand the path her father took, to feel the terrain he walked. On her final trip, she carved, "I love you, Dad," into a summit rock with a Dremel tool. Theories vary. Some believe he took a fatal fall into one of the steep ravines or was buried under a snow bridge. Others think he may have accidentally wandered off course and continued down an unmarked trail. A few suggest wildlife could have been involved, but none of these theories have produced answers. In October 2012, a judge declared Michael Amiter legally dead. His wife later reached a $25,000 settlement with the Seward Chamber of Commerce, and the race implemented new safety rules requiring participants to have completed the course previously. Still, his case remains open. Technically, Michael Amiter is not a dead man. He's a missing person, a man swallowed by a mountain that thousands climb every year. His final moments remain a mystery, and his story remains one of Alaska's most perplexing disappearances, a reminder that sometimes, even in full view, people can simply vanish. The tide was low on a quiet June afternoon in 2003 when two young siblings walking along Beluga Point spotted what they thought was a dead animal tangled in the seaweed. But it wasn't a sheep or a seal. It was the torso of a woman, headless, legless, and dumped into Alaska's Cook Inlet. It was a gruesome discovery, and it was just the beginning. 3 months later, on September 6th, a father and son duck hunting in the Ocean View mudflats, less than a few miles from the first site, found another torso. Again, it was a young woman dismembered in the same way, her remains discarded like the first. The similarities were unmistakable. The violence was calculated. Someone had killed these women and made them disappear, or at least tried to. For over a year, the first victim remained unidentified. But DNA testing eventually revealed she was 22-year-old Desiree Lekanoff, reported missing by a former boyfriend. The second torso was identified more quickly. A distinctive tattoo reading Marty's on the lower back led to 32-year-old Michelle Roth, a fellow inmate at Highland Mountain Correctional Facility, recognized the tattoo and gave police her name. Both women were known to police. Both had worked along Anchorage's notorious Spinard Avenue, a corridor long associated with prostitution and drug activity. Both had histories of addiction, particularly to crack cocaine, and both had been swept into a violent underground world of trafficking and exploitation. At the center of that world were two predators. Don Arthur Webster, a violent pimp known on the street as Jerry Starr, and Joseph Bohm, a wealthy Anchorage businessman who trafficked young women under the nickname Joe Millionaire. Webster was brutal, beating and controlling the women he exploited. Bohm lured girls in with drugs and a place to stay and kept them there with threats. When Bohm was arrested on drug charges in 2003, he made chilling remarks to investigators about a girl named Ruby. Ruby was the alias of Michelle Roth. Bohm never revealed what he knew about the murders. He died in 2014, serving a 13-year sentence for sex trafficking and drug charges. Webster, meanwhile, was convicted and ordered to pay $3.6 million in restitution, one of the largest sex trafficking penalties in U.S. history. The investigation into the torso killings also uncovered at least five other missing women connected to Anchorage's underground scene, including Tracy Vicente, Robin Van Sickle, and Samantha Kent. Whether their disappearances are linked remains unknown. Desiree Lekanoff and Michelle Roth were finally identified, but their killer never was. Fed by glaciers and ringed with beauty, the waters of Cook Inlet seem serene, but for two women, they became a graveyard, their bodies washed ashore in pieces, their stories barely recovered, and the person who left them there, still unknown. Few men have lived closer to the edge of human endurance than Naomi Umara. Soft-spoken and unassuming, the Japanese adventurer built a global reputation by going where no one else dared to go and doing it by himself. By his early 40s, Umara had climbed Kilimanjaro, Aconcagua, and the Matterhorn solo. He became the first person to reach the North Pole by himself, narrowly surviving a polar bear attack and nearly drowning when the ice cracked beneath him. Then he completed a 12,000-kilometer dog sled journey from Greenland to Alaska, a world record at the time. But it was his final expedition, a solo winter ascent of Denali, North America's tallest mountain, that would become his most legendary and his most mysterious. On February 12, 1984, Umara reached the summit of Denali on his 43rd birthday. A bush pilot photographing the mountain spotted him near the peak and received a brief radio transmission confirming the climb. Umara reported that he had descended to about 18,000 feet and planned to reach base camp in the next 2 days. And then, silence. Umara was no stranger to calculated risk. Born in rural Japan in 1941, he began mountain climbing in college as a way to overcome shyness and gain confidence. It worked, though not in the way most people would imagine. Instead of becoming more social, he became more solitary. The mountains gave him purpose, discipline, and something more elusive, peace. For his Denali attempt, he traveled light, no tent, minimal fuel. He intended to sleep in snow caves and ration cold food, even raw caribou, to save weight. He designed his own crevasse rescue device and brought bamboo poles to probe unstable terrain. To those who knew his track record, these choices weren't reckless. They were Umara's way. When he failed to appear at base camp on February 15th, a search effort was launched. At first, there was hope. A pilot named Doug Geeding reported seeing a lone figure waving from an ice cave at 16,000 feet. The next day, however, clouds rolled in, grounding rescue flights. When the skies finally cleared, there was nothing. Searchers found his bamboo poles at 9,500 feet. At 14,000 feet, they found his diary, still tucked away in his gear. And in a snow cave at 17,200 feet, which is usually Denali's high camp, they discovered a haunting cache, his sleeping bag liner, climbing equipment, food, fuel, even film from his camera. But there was no sign that he had ever descended to the point where the pilot had seen him. The last line in his journal read,
"I wish I could sleep in a warm sleeping bag. No matter what happens, I'm going to climb Mount McKinley."
Many believe he attempted to descend the steep headwall between 16,000 and 14,000 feet, one of the most dangerous sections of the mountain, and either fell into a crevasse or was buried by an avalanche. Others have questioned the pilot's sighting altogether. Could it have been a hallucination, a misidentified shadow, or was Umera alive, waving for help, only to be swallowed by the mountain days later? Before 1984, 44 people had died attempting to climb Denali. 23 of their bodies were never recovered. Naomi Umera became the 24th. His disappearance stunned Japan, where he was a national hero. News outlets followed the story for weeks. The government even considered sending a full-scale recovery team, but the mountain wouldn't cooperate. Storms returned. The search was called off. To this day, Naomi Umera's body has never been found, and what happened during those final hours on Denali remain unknown. On a summer evening in 1979, a plane vanished off the radar near Alaska's Kodiak Island. The three people on board were never found. No wreckage, no oil slick, no distress signal beyond a final radio transmission. Among the missing was Ian McIntosh, a former Royal Navy officer, acclaimed television writer, and suspected spy. His disappearance became one of the Cold War's most tantalizing mysteries, blurring the line between fiction and real-life espionage. Born in Inverness, Scotland, in 1940, McIntosh served 18 years in the Royal Navy, rising to the rank of lieutenant commander. His service record was unusual. According to his brother, Lowry, Ian would vanish for long periods, and when he returned, he wouldn't speak of where he'd been. In 1976, he was quietly awarded the Member of the Order of the British Empire. The reason remains classified to this day. After retiring from the military, McIntosh poured his energy into writing, but not just any stories. He created The Sandbaggers, a gritty, tightly wound British spy series that quickly gained a cult following. It was nothing like James Bond. There were no gadgets, no tuxedos, no explosions, just the bleak bureaucracy of real intelligence work, internal politics, moral ambiguity, and agents who died unceremoniously, often for nothing. It was so accurate that some viewers believed it had been based on real operations. Some even questioned whether McIntosh had permission to reveal what he knew. In July 1979, McIntosh and his girlfriend, Susan Insull, a BBC production assistant, were vacationing in Alaska with their friend Graham Barber, a British Airways pilot. They'd flown from London to Honolulu and then on to Anchorage, renting a Raleigh 235 single-engine plane for sightseeing. At 5:45 p.m. on July 7th, Barber radioed a mayday. They were experiencing oil pressure problems. 4 minutes later came the final message.
"This will be our last transmission. We are 500 feet and about to go in."
The plane's last known location was over Shayok Island, at the northern tip of the Kodiak Archipelago. What followed was an exhaustive search. U.S. Coast Guard helicopters and C-130 aircraft scanned more than 75 square miles of ocean and coastline. The weather was clear, Visibility was perfect, but not a single scrap of debris was ever found. The silence only fueled the rumors. Some speculated McIntosh had faked his death and defected to the Soviet Union. Others suggested he'd been, quote, disappeared by Western intelligence, either for what he knew or for what he was planning to reveal. British intelligence officers were reportedly seen at his London flat before the public even knew he was missing. His brother, when he asked a U.S. intelligence contact for help, was told to, quote,
stop asking questions.
The most haunting clue came in the form of a postcard McIntosh had sent to his parents shortly before the trip. It was signed not Love Ian, as usual, but Live Ian. A strange, possibly deliberate slip, or a final encrypted message from a man who trafficked in secrets. After his disappearance, the Sandbaggers continued for one more season, but its creator's absence was palpable. The series ended quietly, no resolution, just like McIntosh himself. Whether he died in a tragic accident or vanished in the shadows of international intelligence, no one can say. What's left is a man-shaped gap in the historical record, a spy novelist who may have become the very thing he once wrote about. Alaska's beauty hides a quiet brutality, one that swallows people whole. Some vanished in plain sight, some were silenced before they could speak, and some are still waiting to be named. These aren't just cold cases, they're reminders that in a place as vast and unforgiving as Alaska, the truth can disappear just as easily as the people. Thanks for listening to Northern Crimes. For more true crime stories from Alaska, Canada, and the Pacific Northwest, you can find us on YouTube, where you can watch engaging videos of these stories. If you enjoy this podcast, make sure and give us a review over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like to support the show, you can find us over on patreon.com/northerncrimes, where you can find bonus content and engage with the community. All right, take care of yourselves. We'll see you next week.